Welcome to the Not Unreasonable Podcast. I'm your host, David Wright, an actuary and reinsurance broker. This is a show of interviews with people who have something to teach us about managing our businesses and ourselves. There's a lot to learn out there, folks, so let's get to work. This show is brought to you by Beach, where I work and have worked my entire career. We are a global reinsurance intermediary, and we pride ourselves on creative thinking, deep analysis, and client service. Those three qualities are actually intimately related because you can't spend the energy digging deep into a problem unless you really care about the client. We find that when you really do understand the problem, the solution becomes obvious, even if it seems a little bit unorthodox to the outside world at first. The nature of insurance is to take solutions we know and trust and try to force them onto the problems of the day. We just don't settle for that. You can see further at beachgp.com. If you're an actuary, you, like me, probably dread the professionalism continuing education requirement. I think that the best time to satisfy this is in podcast time, while on your commute, while walking your dog, while mowing your lawn, while doing the dishes. Head over to notunprofessional.com, where, for the price of a CAS webinar, you can get content dedicated to continuing education for actuaries, especially professionalism CE. That's notunprofessional.com. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting the Not Unreasonable Podcast. My guest today is Todd Hart. Todd has had the following jobs: political campaigner, investment banker, hedge fund trader, hedge fund portfolio manager, private equity investor, reinsurance company CEO, insurance company CEO, and stay-at-home dad. Todd is one of the people in the world I admire most, and I'm honored to have the opportunity to sit down with him today. Todd, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Dave. It's an introduction that would make my mother blush. So,
well, that's a big list of jobs we had there, wasn't it? And a real diversity, in particular industries which are maybe some might say closely related, but maybe not once you get into it. And there was a transition in the early 2000s, right before we met, actually, where you started working on insurance-related transactions. So I'm wondering if you remember the early days of your reinsurance hat, I suppose. And can you think of something that Todd in 2002, let's say, or an average hedge fund manager, maybe even today, wouldn't appreciate about the reinsurance world?
Yeah, I guess there's a lot to think back on from those days. First thing I would think of is it's harder than you think it is. Mm. You know, I think I approached the market transitioning from traditional capital markets to reinsurance markets as being a big one. But you have to make a lot of mistakes along the way, which there's only one way to get knowledge and experience, and that's to make mistakes.
Yeah.
And hopefully, you know, they're oh my gosh is not oh my gods along the way. But, you know, I think I thought, and I think a lot of capital markets people approach the world in trying to simplify things down into kind of a digital format, if you will. And reinsurance is messy. Mm. And in fact, what I describe it a lot is often is the place where the analog world meets the digital world, right? You're dealing with the messiness of you know, catastrophic events or you know, and don't have a ton of experience in casualty, but a lot of these things which are just not as easily defined in a principle you might do for other kind of standard securities.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a consequence, it's just a lot harder.
Yeah.
And I think I did not anticipate how much things like relationships and continuous business over time is one of the ways you manage that complexity. And you know, you still see continuing encroachment or growth in the capital markets into the traditional reinsurance markets, and I think that should continue because
yeah.
It makes a whole lot of economic sense.
Yep.
But there is going to be a disconnect between cultures. And you know, I spent a lot of time translating, you know, what happens in the reinsurance world to the capital markets teams. And, you know, rate online is no different than, you know, yield or interest rate or something. And so that would be probably the primary thing.
What is the culture? What is the culture of the financial markets outside of reinsurance? Maybe you can give some context. And which sort of markets did you work in before you touched reinsurance?
I spent a lot of time in the equity markets.
Okay.
And started my career actually working in like the bond market and swaps business right after business school. Couldn't stand the regular hours and weekends off, that's when I started doing work in corporate finance and M&A world before I left that to go into investing. And I think, you know, probably the simplest way to describe it is And it's actually someone had this conversation with somebody in the reinsurance world, and it was very, very clear in that, you know, we can have a relationship which is no tears. Right. You know, we sit across the table from each other. One of us is going to win, the other is going to lose. And if we understand that's the relationship, that's perfectly fair way to trade, so long as we're clear about that.
Yep.
And then there's another kind of relationship you can have with someone from a transaction standpoint, whereas we're going to be doing this over time.
Yep.
And we anticipate that sometimes I'm going to win and sometimes I'm going to lose and vice versa. But over time, it's going to work out for both of us, right? And that's the way – that's more of a reinsurance concept. And that does not really exist in the capital markets in a fashion. Or if it does, it's very narrow.
You'll never meet again.
Well, the expectation is you won't.
Right.
Right? And, you know, there's much more of that trading mentality. Yeah. Much, much more dominant. I'm not saying it's exclusively the case, but it's certainly more dominant. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know – both are fine. It's just a question of which principle it is you're operating under and making sure you're clear about it.
Does it change the kind of person that exists in the industry? So like your average, your average employee of, say, an investment bank or a hedge fund, do they behave differently in the office based on this difference of behavior outside of the office? Are they different people?
It's hard. That's a hard question. I don't really know how to answer that. Mm. I mean, I think you can have common behaviors of enterprise and creativity and all the elements of it. You know, are people harder, less relationship oriented? It's hard to say.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think these are not binary outcomes. It's not yes or no. It's just degrees of gray.
Yeah.
At least the way I look at it. It's a tough question. I don't know if I can really.
So how about kind of going back to the hedge fund? You were trading public equities at a hedge fund. Well, how was that? I mean, what's interesting to me is you were there probably just before the real blast off, or maybe that was around like kind of late 90s. Maybe it was really kicking off then.
I started actually doing investing work actually almost at the peak of the market and watched it go down for 2 years.
Okay, ouch.
Yeah, which was could have been a good thing. We did fine, but that's like a lot of worlds. We talked about this before, you know, talked about in the past, I should say, where the concept of the Michael Jordan effect, and this is something that, you know, you might remember many, many years ago that Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen were on the Bulls. And I'm not a big basketball fan, but this was so abundantly clear to me. If you weren't the first or second guy on the team, you know, the compensation that you got involved in was good, but not great.
Mm.
And the market, I think, when you go through big turbulence, certainly in the capital markets, it was pretty abundant to me that to get some kind of performance, you need to be in the top decile or quartile in order to attract capital. And that's what we're trying to grow into. And, you know, our performance was good, but not good enough. Mm. And that's why we decided not to continue that. And I rolled on to do some other things.
How'd you get that job? Where did that come from?
It's actually an old high school friend.
Wow.
Who probably one of the smartest guys I know, asked me and one other guy to relocate from New York to Dallas.
Yeah, tell us the story of your geographical. You were from Dallas originally, and you were in New York at that time.
That's right. I was living in New York. My wife and I had our two kids. We were prepared to kind of slog it out, even though...
Right, living in Manhattan.
Upper West Side. And, you know, my son's, among his first words, were taxi, which has its own sense of warpness. But... we happened to be in Dallas at a friend's wedding, and my other buddy hatched this idea of starting a fund in Dallas, doing something that was quite interesting, and he asked me to engage him in that little adventure. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that list of stuff that you wrote about earlier, or talked about earlier, is a lot of it's just kind of fall on your nose.
Yeah.
Right? The opportunity made sense, and you jumped on it. Some of them worked really well. Some of them did okay. And decided not to continue, and that's the way that goes.
Right. So from there, the public equities kind of strategy, mixed bag, not enough to be Michael Jordan.
Right.
And then so you moved on to the next hedge fund, I guess.
Yeah, the partners of HBK sponsored this other fund.
I see.
And so I was already already kind of known by them.
In the ecosystem.
Exactly right. And so I was sponsored by, at that point in time, by a partner of HBK, Will Rose, to build a business around insurance for HBK.
Okay.
And that started out with very simply a telephone and a Bloomberg machine and said, go build it.
Why did he pick you?
you have to ask him.
Yeah. What do you think? Would you have picked you if you were him?
You know, I, I've always been comfortable dealing with ambiguity and trying to structure ambiguity.
Right.
And I think that's a large portion of it, because you take on a big project like that with very little boundary. You know, the question is, how are you going to make progress, right? Because you could boil the ocean in trying to go into the reinsurance business. But that's never, you know, it takes a lot of focus in trying to reduce it down to the basics.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's something that I've certainly tried to do in most places I've been, and certainly my last several jobs tried to do that. But I think he had a lot of confidence in me to do that, which, you know, is I'm really grateful for.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it takes a remarkable, I don't know, sense of what you really want to do to take somebody out of an entity or a strategy that wasn't a smashing success and say, I'm going to grab a guy from that strategy and put them in something which I know even less about and hope it works out. I mean, you must have had a good relationship with him.
Yes,
at the time.
Did and do. Yeah. And, you know, he's one of the best guys I've ever worked with.
Yeah.
And he's very good at kind of setting direction and then kind of getting out of your way, right? Which is the way I like to operate. I'm not particularly good with micromanagement.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have a lot of contact with each other. We've known each other for quite a while, so a high degree of trust. And I think he knew that, you know, I was going to play straight and, you know, figure out at the end of the day. Well, you know, the whole thing about the fund I was with that we closed it down, I mean, look, you know, there's this whole concept, I know it's certainly very prevalent for anybody, and my wife picked up on it, who's from London originally in Texas, this concept in Texas that it's better to have tried and failed than not to have tried,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's okay, as long as you played right and you played correctly and you got up afterwards and dust yourself off and get back on. But, you know, I think that's a lot of what came out of that experience when I was at Cimarron, which was the fund I was talking about earlier.
Yeah.
And
What did you learn? What did you learn from that failure? Anything specific come to mind?
Well, the first thing I learned is that the difficulty in having an edge in financial services is crushingly difficult.
Yep.
And, you know, smart guys working really hard and finding some edge and maintaining it, it was really very difficult and much, much harder than I anticipated. It's the first time I'd really been a trader, per se, or an investor in that to that extent. And I think that colored my thinking as to why I wanted to get into the reinsurance business from a capital market side, which is, you know, that's no smaller a market, but at least there the information is more opaque.
Mm-hmm.
And information opacity, you know, creates opportunities. Whereas if you're trying to trade information in a trade on stocks and use information to do that, whether it's stocks or bonds, you know, that information is pretty efficiently distributed. You know, there's always stuff you don't know, right? There's things that are inside. You can't trade on that because your stripes go horizontally, not vertically, if you do that. But it's really finding that edge, which is really quite difficult. Mm-hmm. And in the reinsurance world, you know, my sense is that that edge probably was greater historically than it is now.
Yep.
A lot of that's getting competed away, whether it's because of the introduction of the capital markets, which is a lot of capital, and that will certainly drive margins down, but also the competitive edge and knowledge of what risk is inherent in a contract is been substantially standardized, you know, through cap models. And so that creates a language under which you can trade on, and that will reduce margins as well. So you have to search for the next thing.
You do, yeah. And that's a competitive market, right?
Yeah, that's a competitive market.
Staying on public equities just for a second, how much insider trading do you think there was out there? That seems to me one way that on paper, or at least in my conception, it's a pretty common edge people might just reach for in hedge fund trading or any kind of trading.
Probably more than I believed.
Yeah.
I certainly did not see that in the environments I was in directly, whether it was in either of the two funds I was operating with, but... because, you know, I came from Wall Street before. I was at J.P. Morgan, you know, and that whole insider trading thing was it was kind of one of the third rails. I mean, you very clearly reputational issues, notwithstanding, you know, you just didn't do it, right, for obvious reasons, and spent a lot of time understanding that. So it was, you know, it's just kind of the condition where you come from.
Mm-hmm.
So do people ignore that and try to trade on it? Absolutely. I'm sure they do.
Yeah.
There are always people that try to break the rules.
Yeah. There's this puzzle, right, of hedge fund performance where they were quite clearly outperforming in, you know, call it pre-crisis, and it's not as clear since then about the outperformance? I mean, it depends on how you measure it. Any reflections on that? What do you think is going on there?
I think a lot of competitive edge. The markets, they were – the competitive edge has been diminished,
yeah.
Right? I think you have a lot of money chasing very similar opportunity set. And, you know, it's no genius if there's a lot of capital supply going after a limited opportunity that those margins are going to go down.
Yeah.
You know, I don't, you know, whether it's, there hasn't been a lot of merger business. That was a big strategy for a long time pre-crisis.
Mm.
Certainly even in the 90s, you know, the convertible bond business, which was, you know, that was a big business for folks in the late 90s and early 2000s. I think a lot of those margins are gone. Credit spreads are tight. You know, it's just a lot of reasons why, you know, capital is trying to find something interesting and good to do, but it's, you know, all of them have the same models now.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like almost, you know, knowledge of what a good price for wind risk is a lot more transparent than it was historically. The same thing in that markets as well. So I think that's probably the biggest driver. But I haven't been in that business for about 10 years plus. Yeah. So it's really hard to say for sure.
And do you think that the price signal is less reliable? Maybe in the catastrophe business, I think about this sometimes. Where look at the excess loss pricing or whatever there is out there on catastrophe risk, and it goes up and down. It's, you know, sort of steadily declining. And I'm wondering what you think that might reflect. Is that a reevaluation of the risk? Is that something else? Any thoughts on that?
I think the pricing was actually quite robust in that marketplace,
yep.
And because I think about the trading environments. Which, you know, I've operated through. I really got active in 2003, 2004, and then traded through 2005 and 2006, which, you know, that was a very different marketplace, right?
Yeah,
to be a seller of risk at that point. And so you think about post-Katrina KRW 2005, it wasn't just that, right, that caused the issues. We had the change in the AM Best capital models, as mm-hmm. well as the RMS changed their modeling. So you had multiple factors that caused a rapid need and increase in demand for capital, and the supply was very skittish.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a consequence, you know, rate online for even simple trades like ILWs, you know, doubled, not more. And there's no necessary competitive edge in that. Right, per se, because it's
the right place, the right time.
Right place, right time. Right, and which is a competitive edge, right?
Yes.
A form of it, but it's not like you had, you know, informational insight that that others couldn't have. But I think what's happening is, as you know, it was pretty obvious to me that certainly pension funds and the more institutional capital should be in this marketplace directly, whether it's through cat bonds or something similar, because you know it's a. If you add an uncorrelated asset, which you're getting a margin on, you should improve your returns,
mm-hmm.
right? I'm no genius about that stuff, but it mm-hmm. seems that's the way the math's supposed to work. So what's happened, I think, over that time frame from 2005 through now is a combination of credit spreads generally spreads for traditional credit has gone down. People have been searched for yield has also gone, but the ability to get yield has gone down. So they've chased newer markets from – and so with so much capital going into that business, into the catastrophe business, it's not terribly surprising that returns have gone down.
Yeah.
Right? It's just a lot of supply. And so that's why I think it does reflect the risk factors. I think probably reinsurers were getting paid over the odds, well over the odds for quite a while, which makes it attractive. But now other people figured that out
mm-hmm.
and are able to supply capital to that marketplace.
And there's an alternative – there's some sort of reading of the facts, which so I think is underappreciated. So let me give it to you and let you mm-hmm. react. And that is that their supply and demand does not drive reinsurance pricing at all. It's got nothing to do with that. It'll also do with the last 5 years' experience. And so capital's decision to come – so supply is actually a consequence. So it's a symptom, not a cause, right? And so the supply emerges because people believe that that they understand what's going on. And so it's a reflection on uncertainty. So I did an interview with Paul Ingrey a little while ago, and he's got a very simple kind of way of thinking about the reinsurance market, which is all based on fear. If people are scared, prices are going up. If they're not scared, prices are going down. That theory for the operation of the market does not include supply, right? So supply is attracted to an environment of certainty, or maybe uncertainty, I suppose, depending on which kind of supply we're talking about here. I'll say it put it differently. I think that capital is attracted to environments of certainty, and uncertainty capital leaves. And so you need different capital providers to turn up. I'm not necessarily advocating for like a pure version of that, but I'm wondering what you think about it.
Well, I think if fear is the governing issue in this, I actually say fear probably governs supply. That's how I would
right,
think the two.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And
I
would just think back to the situation where in 2005. Well, actually, when I first started it in the capital, putting together an insurance business or reinsurance that was cat driven, I had a lot of conversations with the senior people at the firm saying, "Look, if you're not comfortable putting money back to work when Miami looks like Venice,
yeah,
don't do this.
Right.
Don't even put the first dollar in, because it's going to happen. I mean, it's not because you or I or anybody else here control that outcome. It's just that's the nature of things. And you have to be prepared to be big after an event."
Can capital providers credibly commit to that, do you think? So you can go to somebody who's running a fund or something like that, say, you know, you got to be committed. And that person, mm-hmm. maybe in that person's committee that sits behind them is like, yeah, we're in for that. Is there another layer of evaluation that occurs, or at what point does it occur that they could actually get the rug pulled out from underneath?
Absolutely,
them?
We all could, right? Yeah. There's no contractual obligation to follow through on that,
yeah.
right? At the end of the day, you know, I'm trying to give somebody my best advice on how you actually approach a marketplace.
Yeah.
And if they decide they want to do something different, you know, the results will be different. It's it's a question of who controls the allocation of the capital.
Yeah.
So yeah, we actually, you know, you think about. You know, we had the financial crisis in, you know, in 2007, 8, and 9. You know, rates did not really move that much, right? It kept going down over that time frame. So probably didn't make a whole lot of sense to put more and more capital in the cap markets unless you were already committed to it. Mm-hmm. But you think about what happened in 2005 and 2006, you know, there was a massive increase in rates.
Yep.
And so we massively increased our bets over that time frame. And whereas 2005 was a really rough year, as you would expect.
And 4 was as well. I mean, I remember 2004 was the biggest hurricane year on record.
Yeah.
Right? You had Charlie, Francis, Ivan, and Gene.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next year, you had literally the biggest hurricane year
ever.
I mean, everybody could ever right. imagine. We went into the
Six
alpha,
sigma
beta,
experience.
Gamma.
Exactly.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. In January, more. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, you think if you're a capital provider who's already in that business, and you're linearly extrapolating from 2004, 2005, you're like, oh my God, 2006, right? We're going to be starting making movies about this stuff. And then you're like, I'm out.
Mm-hmm. Could be. But I mean, the same thing happens when people are betting on any kind of performance. Right?
Yeah.
You have to actually, you're trying to peer into the future,
yeah.
right? And something about the, what is it? The future is very uncertain.
Yeah. I'm not sure what genius said that.
Exactly. It's like, all the predictions are wrong, especially the ones about the future.
Yeah. Like
Yogi Berra kind of
poorly
paraphrased. But just what do you think realistically is going to happen?
Mm-hmm.
And it would have been a disaster to put more capital down in 2006 and have that make, you know, if that had turned out to be worse than 2005 or even a quarter of 2005, it would have been really rough.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, sometimes persistence, if you have a fundamental view about what should be happening in the marketplace, in a natural market like that, you know, you're going to, you know, you got to stick with it and in order to make money.
Is that strategic thinking, let's say, about capital allocation? What I would imagine is that's identical no matter what kind of institution you're in. So if you're in an investment bank, if you're in an equity hedge fund, if you're in kind of a prop, you know, a proprietary trading kind of hedge fund, which is how we might characterize the insurance-linked securities business you're running, reinsurance, insurance, will preview future part of your career here and, you know, say you did run those companies too. Is that the same? Do they all look at this kind of in basically the same way?
Well, I guess the question, I'd probably turn the problem around. I mean, and say it's not just limited to capital, right? You think about your resources.
Yep,
you're just
sure.
doing resource allocation, period, whether it's time,
people,
attention, money, you know, a lot of what you have to do when you're a manager or, you know, running anything really is to – you're allocating. And what do you think the most probable outcome is going to – the most beneficial use of those resources? And so, yeah, I guess there is a universality across those things. It depends what – you know, if you're running a fund, your biggest resource that you have besides time, which is always your biggest resource,
right?
You know, capital is a huge one, right? But it's no different if you're running a reinsurance broker, mm-hmm. right? How are you going to spend your time and whatever precious resources you have, you know, that you could otherwise not spend and increase your margins,
mm-hmm.
right? Then you have the same same questions.
So. How about risk management, capital allocation, those kinds of functions, those kinds of call it domains of expertise. Any thoughts on contrasting that between the capital markets and then the insurance, reinsurance world?
It's all basically the same principles.
Yeah.
Measure. Keep it simple and measure. It's probably, I'm sure there are folks that are doing very sophisticated jobs. When we were putting together our own tools, it was really simple stuff. You know, what's your PMLs? What are your limits? Things like that.
What's the worst that could happen?
I think one of the big differences in the insurance and reinsurance world versus the capital markets is, you know, when you're writing an insurance, the sum of the limits that you write relative to your capital.
Yeah.
Definition
of leverage.
Yeah, you do not want to be publishing that, right? Yeah. Because it's a really scary number for a lot of folks who are not used to seeing that environment.
Yep.
But then if you turn that around and equate it to, you know, you own the equity slug of a CDO, it's not dramatically different.
Interesting.
Right? It's just a question of, you know, what capital do you have ahead of you? So we had a lot of conversations around, you know, what is your limit? And that's why reinsurance, I think, works pretty well for a fund. Because, you know, they want to know what the absolute downside is, right? And I do too. I mean, everybody should. And, you know, theoretically with an insurance company, your absolute downside is whatever capital you have provided, but your leverage is quite dramatic.
Yeah.
And it's actually pretty dramatic in reinsurers as well, but in insurance, it's just off the charts.
Yeah. It's incredible. I mean, if you take – I did an exercise once where, you know, you thought about what are the limits exposed on, say, GL, the United States. I mean – we don't even use the kind of magnitudes, like it's whatever's after quadrillion, you know, it's just
right.
Like
these are really big numbers.
Yeah. I mean, incredibly.
It's like astrophysical.
Yeah, number. Right. Yeah. You start doing scientific notation to define the leverage ratio of the insurance industry. So HBK, the ending of there, that was financial crisis related stuff, mm-hmm. right? Not your fault. You just didn't. Right place, wrong time, I guess.
Yeah, and I think we had a large investment in a company called Glacier at the time, and the CEO wanted to go one way and the board wanted to go another. And I jokingly said I was in the bathroom when they selected the new CEO because I came out and they said, guess what you get to do? Did I mention this opportunities in Switzerland?
Was that another Will Rose driven decision?
Yeah, it was actually Will Rose and a couple other guys I worked with a lot from family office, Alex Friedland and Sergeant Vukovic and Ravi Yadav, kind of encouraged me to go do all that because they were all on the board together. And at that point in time, actually, Bill Riker was consulting and helping out in the background. And so I thought it was a great opportunity because, first of all, built on a lot of things that I was pretty comfortable with, which is ultimately we knew we needed to get liquidity for the investors because that was that's where the puck was going. So I knew I could do that. I mean, I've bought and sold businesses before, so it kind of built on my investment banking background and was familiar enough with the subject matter of running, you know, being involved in reinsurance because I've been investing on this board and different activities. But what was new was actually running a company.
Right.
And doing that in Switzerland.
So you're still living in Dallas, and they asked you to go run this company in Switzerland.
Yes.
Wow.
So, you know, it was pretty rough. Would not recommend that as a lifestyle choice.
Yeah. Commuting to Switzerland
yes.
from Texas. I can imagine.
And
so what are the specifics? So what did you was like 2 weeks on, 1 week off kind of thing?
Yeah, it's been a couple weeks over there and then back.
Right.
Back for a week.
And your family. How old were your kids at the time?
My son was 12 and my daughter was 10.
Right.
You know, not great.
Yeah.
We did that for a couple of years. It was not a fun time. It's probably a large reason why, you know, previewing where we're going to go next,
yeah.
We moved to relocated to Rhode Island at some point. But it's, you know, it was something that, you know, from a career standpoint, you know, I've kind of followed my nose.
Yeah.
And ultimately, I think actually I've enjoyed and running companies more than anything else that I've ever done.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and in Switzerland, the challenge was, you know, I was brought there. We had to figure out what we had and what we could do with it. And there were two pieces of it. There was an insurance business and a reinsurance piece. And the question was just finding the right homes for all the pieces. Mm-hmm. And we had an interesting problem because, you know, I evaluated that as being, we had a really good company. Like the people were good, the systems, the processes. It would actually was generating good business and decent margins and good processes and so on. But the opportunity set for a small reinsurer was small.
Yeah.
And the tide was going against us. Mm-hmm. So the business need was not really there. The insurance business actually was quite a good one, and that is one we ended up selling to Taurus, which launched their European specialty business. And they did a lot of great things with it, which is awesome. They had a lot more risk appetite than we did, and so it was a perfect trade. They could do more with it than what we were prepared to do. We didn't write a lot of casualty, for instance. It's just not something we had a lot of background in, so we didn't do it. They did. They liked it. It's a big part of the European market. Away they went. And so I was left with a reinsurance business, which I needed to try to sell. And we made a tough decision, which is we actually put it into a self-managed runoff. Because at that point in time, we couldn't find someone who wanted to buy effectively a pile of cash.
Yeah.
We had like $50 million of premium and $300 or $400 million worth of cash. And so, you know, we were one of the few companies that I'm aware of that actually was completely super solvent when we decided to stop writing business. Mm-hmm. And, but it was the right call. We just weren't making the margins and the returns that were required for our capital. So then we had to go about trying to sell that. But in order to create a competitive process, we put together a self-managed runoff. And I do remember a time I had to get in front of all the employees and say, we're all going to be going.
Yeah.
And here's the, and maybe because it's in Switzerland, I gave them a schedule, so it worked. And I was not the last guy on that list, right? There were people, I was, towards the below the halfway through, but I was still not the last guy. There were other people who were going to turn the lights out behind me.
Yeah.
And, but I think that whole process of just being clear and transparent, even through rough times, was a really big learning lesson for me because I had lots of tough conversations. I had to let executives go who'd been there, and that's never easy. Just tough set of questions trying to do turnarounds.
So if there's a difference between kind of the, I don't know, almost the up the ivory tower, allocating capital, making kind of investment decisions, doing deals, and now you're dealing with people running a company.
Mm-hmm.
How, when you turn up, can you maybe reflect a little bit on the learning process of what that's like? I mean, you show up and you're not sure what you're going to do yet, and they're probably all terrified. They're all going to get fired. Who's this guy? This guy from Texas. He's just commuting from Dallas. This can't last. He's just going to fire us all. That must be what's going through their minds. I don't know how much of that was expressed and how would you deal with that?
Well, I was a little bit fortunate in this circumstance because I'd been around the company for 6 years.
Okay.
And so I knew all the employees practically. I didn't know the depth, but I certainly knew the senior management team.
Yeah.
I think people knew that I was, I wasn't coming in just to – I was trying to figure out what to do.
Yeah.
Right? And it was pretty clear after a while what the answer was. The board may have been there before me, but I needed to kind of get there myself.
Right.
And they gave – fortunately, they generously gave me the time to get there myself and actually move the team along.
Mm-hmm.
I knew it was a little bit of a training wheels exercise for me on that. I mean, because I had that background. It wasn't like I was coming completely cold.
Yeah.
That very different than Narragansett, where it was a very different circumstance. But it's, a lot of it's just being transparent, and trying to be as clear as you can and saying, good, bad, or indifferent.
Did they ask you? Did they say, what are we going to do, Todd?
Mm-hmm.
And then what did you say before you had decided? You're like, I'm not sure yet. Here's the plan.
Here's the plan. Here's how I'm going to go about trying to solve this problem.
Yeah.
And, the range of outcomes could be everything from, we're going to need to have some kind of change of control at some point.
Yeah.
And if we can find someone who could buy us and continue to operate what we are as a business, then that would be a great outcome we'd like to consider.
Was there a fair amount of attrition? People leave?
Not really.
Hmm.
Not Why really. Not?
Shouldn't they have left? I gotta get out of this thing. What do you think?
No, we're making money,
yeah.
Right? I mean, it's still a profitable, healthy business. I mean, it's part of what you have to, I think people get, you talked about fear causing, we talked about fear causing changes in supply of capital. I think that actually has a big impact on people's behavior as well.
Yeah.
And I think to the extent that, you can try to clarify the uncertainty of the future, even if, I didn't know what the answer was going to be, but we said, here's the range of outcomes. Here's how we're going to go about solving it. And, it certainly begins to unfog what the future is.
Yep.
And that, I don't know if that had some impact on it.
Mm-hmm.
We also, don't forget, you can actually also give people plenty of incentive by making sure it's worth their financial while to sit around too, right?
That's sure. Also, if you're making money, you have the luxury.
You have the luxury of working on that question. And fortunately, the board got that one quickly, that allowed me to, to make it work worth people's while.
Mm-hmm.
And, So I think both things matter.
Yeah. Do you remember the first time, this might be here or elsewhere in your career, that you had to let somebody go?
Mm-hmm.
What was that like, first time?
It's terrible, right? And Dale Hammond, who's on, who we've worked with off and on for over a decade, you know, says, you know, if it ever gets easy,
right,
quit.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you still have to sleep with yourself at night, you know, or wake up in the morning and be able to be comfortable with that. But, you know, just because it's uncomfortable and painful emotionally doesn't mean you shouldn't necessarily do it. It may be the right business decision, mm-hmm. and that's what your job is. And so, you know, a lot of life is holding contrasting ideas in your brain and still functioning.
Yeah.
Right? I think that's a good one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it can not be fun, but it can actually be quite emotionally difficult. But again, I've always tried to have when I do with that is that unless you've done something terribly wrong, I'm going to try to make sure you have your dignity and a good runway and whatever we can to make that work for somebody. You know, if you've crossed the line, I have no problem letting the door hit you in the back of the head.
Yeah.
You know, but it's, you know, I think if you approach it like that, it makes me feel like I can live with myself.
Yeah. You know, I can think of situations that I'm familiar with where there's clearly a problem and somebody has to go, but nobody wants to pull the trigger because everybody's scared of the confrontation,
mm-hmm.
right?
Nobody likes that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an awful feeling. It's almost like solving an awful problem with another awful solution. It's brutal.
Yeah, well, you know, there's all these kind of aphorisms you use in management. One of them is to hire slow and fire fast.
Yeah, right.
And I think that's really meant more for onboarding people. Like if you've made a mistake, don't think you're going to kind of work your way out of it.
Yeah.
That's, I'm sure if you ask any manager or anybody who's trying to lead a business, that's a common problem is you just hang on too long with folks. And I've certainly been guilty of it. So.
Yeah. I mean, it's a difficult thing. It's a difficult thing to, because I think that one of the, and I know something I learned from you is you gotta care about the people, right? And you gotta build those relationships and then to then end one. In some ways, it's almost an admission of failure, right? That you weren't able to solve the problem or fix the issue or whatever, overcome some problem that was there, which is makes it, you know, it's kind of layers another kind of bit of difficulty on the thing.
Well, if you think you're going to succeed at everything you do, you probably aren't challenging yourself enough.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, you're going to make a call, whether it's a person or a business, you know, adventure you're going after, and not all of them are going to work,
mm-hmm.
right? The question is why? Did you learn from it, I guess, is, you know. That seems to be more the relevant question. Yeah, and it's also, I mean, when I've had to let people go, it's also how you maintain the relationship,
yep.
right? And it's, you know, again, if you've treated them well and you give them a chance to have dignity when they leave and the right circumstances, there's no reason you can't have an ongoing relationship. It's just different.
Mm-hmm.
That's not unusual either. I mean, mm-hmm. it is, I still have a lot of friends in Switzerland. And, you know, think about that. Or,
yeah.
Had to deconstruct the company we were all working on.
Yeah.
But, you know.
It was the right decision. And if people, I guess the big lesson there is, you know, it's, and we were talking about this before we started recording today, which was transparency and just being open and communicating with people is, you know, it's, it just makes it palatable. It makes it possible.
It's about the best way I can, you know, look, the best way I can figure out how to, you know, maintain a relationship.
Yeah, it's so simple. And you have to learn over and over again, and it's amazing, isn't it?
And, you know, we're always opportunity to be more, quote, transparent. There's no, you know, perfectly 100% transparent, the standard. But if your intention is driving that way, I think that's probably, at least in my experience, a reasonable start.
So how long did it last in Switzerland? How long were you doing that commute altogether?
About 2 years.
Right.
And
boy, that's a long time.
The probably the party that benefited the most, and when I stopped doing it, American Airlines called me and said, "Is everything okay?" And I said, "For me, it is.
Yeah.
Maybe not for y'all."
Yeah. Wow. How long was that flight? Was that how long before you walk out of the house in Dallas and you I don't know when you got in Zug or I guess as it was
Fafacon. Door to door, it was about 24 hours.
Right.
Because we'd fly from Dallas to Frankfurt and then take a small jumper plane to Zurich and then drive. And it was a long time.
Yeah. So 2 years of that. And then you're done. Mm-hmm. Last time, what was it like coming home after that last flight? You know, what did you do?
Yeah, I slept a lot. Yeah, actually, it was an interesting time because that was the first time in my career when I really decided to take time off.
Yep.
And I've talked to a number of my buddies who are in the executive search business, and they say midterm executives that take some time off, it's inevitably a good thing.
Yeah.
Right. Because, I've been busting chops for 20 odd years doing investment banking or fund management and, making executive platinum by April kind of thing for, 20 years. And it's a good idea to maybe reassess at some point. And I was fortunate to be able to do so. So I took about a year off.
A year.
And played around with projects and, really started getting serious. And I'm use air quotes around that, but about six to nine months into that, I started literally looking out. For the first 6 months, I didn't do anything.
Signals were being recharged. That's how long it took.
Exactly. I was waiting for my, be led that way.
Yeah.
And
What'd you do for the 6 months? What'd you do? I mean, you drive your kids to school or whatever. what do you do?
Yeah, the first part of it was actually quite entertaining because, I was the one historically in my wives and my relationship, on the road working the long hours, and she was running a charity auction for our daughter's school at Hockaday in Dallas, and it was a huge project. And so she was working the 80 hours a week, and I was driving the kids to school, going to coffee with the moms and yoga in the morning. And it was all like, I'm living this dream. I got to get some more of this.
what a change
it was
of pace.
It was a really fun change of pace. And fortunately, it didn't last, but it was a great time. And it's,
at that point, your kids are 14 and 11 or 12?
Yeah, they're basically in middle school.
Yep.
And so, drive them to school, pick them up, do all that fun stuff.
Reconnect.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
And it's a challenge when your parent travels that much.
Yeah.
But, fortunately, we've got great relationships and we wanted to be together, and that's why we decided to move later. So that was a big part of it.
So the next, you're evaluating opportunities, and then tell me about Narragansett. How did that come up? What was the phone call?
Whenever Alex Friedland calls me, I usually end up moving. I've stopped taking his calls.
Yeah.
He's a great guy, absolutely, really, really dear friend, and he called me up. He and Ravi were thinking about what they wanted to do next and had this opportunity in Narragansett Bay Insurance Company in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, selling coastal homeowners insurance. And, it was a really good business proposition that needed a little bit of discipline and focus in order to let that opportunity shine. And I'd looked at enough business plans to know that, you're looking for something that has an edge.
Yeah.
Right. And it's so difficult to find one in financial services. I mean, it always is difficult, and I think it's gotten harder.
How many did you look at, you think, through that period? Like one a week, or you email people and say, hey, Todd, check this out?
If I had to go back and look at it, probably inventoried about 10.
Yeah, okay.
And some of them were my own, too. So, come up with my own ideas, and see if I can actually – and I'm testing them. Right? Yep. Do I think this actually works or not?
Yeah.
And, and it's always a challenge to kind of be objective because – you can fall in love with your ideas and think, "Oh, we'll do it differently, right? We'll be better. Well, why, right?" And but the proposition at Narragansett made a whole lot of sense to me because basic fundamental supply and demand. And if people are not selling product where people are living, you should be able to make a good living.
This is kind of through late 2011, early 2012. You're looking
That's right.
at this.
That's right. Early 2012, and. Narragansett was been operating in its current form since about 2008, and so had a couple of years of really beginning to sell policies and growing like a weed, but needed to go from growth to profitable growth, and so they wanted someone to come in and do that. I started looking at it in the beginning of 12 and got hired on in May, and pretty quickly realized, we did a lot of things needed to change because, we were selling, but maybe a little too cheaply.
And so were you expecting to walk into a situation kind of like Glacier?
No, I think the opposite problem.
Right. The Glacier, and that was not a surprise to you though.
No, not a surprise at all. I mean, I've done a lot of evaluation. I think I tried to, I sent them like a 100 and plus line due diligence list.
Interesting. Who would you send that to?
I sent it to the board guys who were trying to hire me.
Right.
And, you know, they came back and I'm kind of freaking out. And I said, look, if you can answer all this stuff, that would be impressive.
Yeah.
But what you can't answer tells me what's really going on.
Yep.
Right? So it was as much an evaluation of what was there and what wasn't there as a way to kind of smoke out what I was really dealing with.
Yep.
But in essence, what we had is the opposite problem. We had a Glacier, which Glacier I thought was a really reasonably good company, like the team and all that stuff that was there. The business was ebbing away from us. Mm-hmm. And what we had at Narragansett was the opposite issue. The business was – there was demand for this product. We just weren't organized and mature enough yet. And, you know, I described – maybe because I was just dealing with my kids going through their own puberty. I described this as being kind of the early stage of an awkward teenager years.
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, you think about your kid at that point. It just kind of drives you nuts from time to time. Right?
Yeah.
You love and adore them, but you're like, wow, is that really what you decided
to do? I got 5 years before I hit that top.
You'll be there.
Yeah, I know.
You'll be reflecting on this, hopefully.
Yeah.
And hopefully others as well. But it's so yeah, I walked in. I kind of knew that this was a bit of a social challenge. In fact, the financial issues were really clear to me. But it was as much about cultural behavioral change as anything else, as much as anything I've ever dealt with.
Yeah.
Whereas I didn't have to deal with that at Glacier. I mean, it was – there's a much more professionalism, maturity, and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. And so we just stick to the basics and, you know, just really simple stuff. I mean, you know, people would go to meetings and we'd have an agenda and who, what, by when follow-up. Mm-hmm. And you start doing that and you build on it little bit by little bit. And the next thing you know, you're starting to show success. And that just kind of builds on itself.
So where did you learn how to do that? Where did you learn how to identify and fix management problems? Glacier, somewhere else, somebody teach you, somebody put you on to something?
You know, probably the accumulation of everything I've done over my lifetime. I told my mom the other day, I said, a lot of what I do at Narragansett is what you taught me is like, you know, when I was in school, make a list, do the first thing on the list until it's done, do the next thing on the list. Mm-hmm. It's just not complicated. But there are a lot of tools you can use that, you know, that I think I picked up on through history. I mean, there's things like manager tools and, you know, the kind of some of the things we've talked about in the past.
Yeah, which, sure.
You know, kind of the if you get the basics correct, one-on-ones, delegation, you know, coaching and
Feedback. So that's the – I mean, we'll put a plug in for manager tools. Yeah. This is a resource that Todd put me on to when I first started taking a management role. And this is to the audience. Download the Manager Tools app. Listen to the podcast.
Yeah, it's one of the more impressive podcasts I've ever heard because it's effective and practical.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And you know, so those guys and the two Marks do a great job on that.
Yeah.
So, very, 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 very big fan. And the so yeah, I started doing the basics there. Yeah. That was always helpful because, and we've talked a little bit about this that so much of it's based on relationships. Mm. And relationships start with lots of conversations. And if you have regular conversations, you can build up that social capital, which allows you to have tougher conversations.
Yep.
And because business isn't always a roses. Yeah. You know? You have to have some tough conversations from time to time. So you better have more likely to be successful the more you know each other.
So this is, and for those following along at home, this is Todd running a homeowner's coastal business in the Northeast in early 2012. What happened in the end of 2012?
You would think actually my history is really good because we started Glacier. We started underwriting operating Glacier in 2005.
Yeah.
So its first year of operation was Katrina, Rita, Wilma.
Yeah.
So now I'm showing up at my homeowner's opportunity. And in the summer of 12, I tell people I was still trying to figure out where the coffee machine was and this thing called Superstorm Sandy. Hit four states, the four we operate in. And yeah. Basically devastated the company, right? And, as I said to the team that was there at the time, you know, this is what we're built for. And in so many ways, I say to anybody who would want to listen afterwards, it's going to make the company because it tested the business proposition and the company did a really good job operationally. From an underwriting standpoint, you know, we beat people's expectations. We took a high-risk portfolio and we actually, through a combination of good decisions and inspections and whatnot, in order to underwrite, and it performed in line or a little bit better than the models.
So what happens inside of a coastal insurance company kind of just before, during, and just after a storm? What's that like? What is the operational kind of, you know, experience?
Well, the way Narragansett worked is the entire management team goes on first call, and so everybody there is going to be taking claims to start with, because you just get a flood and
20,000 claims, was it, something like that?
Yeah, and you're talking, how do you manage over 100,000 phone calls?
100,000 phone calls,
right?
With what's the staff count?
We have about at that point in time we had about 90 people,
right?
So everybody's taking claims. Even our chairman Nick Steffi, who was the gentleman who got the whole thing started, he was in the next office. You know, when I hear him talking to people, we're all doing it, and that's just kind of how you ramp up.
Yeah,
and then you backfill with claims folks in order to manage that. But it's a lot of operational responsibility. And we were fortunate in the sense during that time frame, one of our directors, Dale Hammond, helped out and kind of was the Sandy executive, if you will, because that became a business for us, is to make sure all the trains are running on time, people getting satisfied, all the things that are going to break down, because inevitably your plan will get challenged and your systems will get challenged and you got to solve those problems. You know, he helped run that for it while I was working on the rest of the business. And so it was very helpful. To manage that. But it's, you know, I think if you've ever been in a claims process before, you know, claims managers, I have an enormous amount of respect for them.
I don't know anything about that.
The adjusting process. Well, you're one part psychologist.
Interesting.
And one part technical specialist, right? Because think about what you're dealing with in a catastrophic event, or any catastrophic, whether it's a hurricane or a fire or something like that. You're talking to somebody who is emotionally distraught. And you got to help them through it. And you got to do that without becoming emotional yourself or burned out. And if you're trained,
you're doing it, I don't know how long does a call take, and
it varies.
Yeah,
but I mean, you could be doing 10, 15, 20 a day if you're not built for that, you're not trained on it. You know, it can be tough. And so we had a little bit of burnout questions for folks, right? But we anticipated that, and but I think that's part of the realization and I think it's important that we realize this is why we're here. Right, we're here to solve, to help responsible homeowners, get back on their feet. And so even as this, senior executives, it's important to have that feedback directly, and very rarely do you get it that cleanly
from your customers.
And
do you remember your first call?
Yeah.
How's that? What was it? Can you tell the story about it? How does the phone work? Are you sitting down? You're like, okay,
we routed everything to their desk. But
okay.
It was a lady who called and said, "Look, I've got I've got water coming into my garage."
When is this? Is this while the storm's still happening, or
right after? Right. Okay. I mean, the storm lasts for a couple of days.
It hit on a Sunday or Monday.
Yeah,
or something,
exactly.
Right?
I think it was on Sunday night. We started getting calls.
Right.
So right immediately. And, she was it was a relatively low-keyed call, we just gave her, in her circumstance, we were going to be dealing with flooding issues, which was a really big question around Sandy. We can go into that if you want, but which is, as everybody knows, homeowners is not covered by flood. Flood is not covered by homeowners. And the, so in her circumstance, it was like,
this isn't going to work.
This is going to be we'll give you the flood denial.
Did you give her a flood denial? Did you say, how'd you communicate that to her? Why do you say that? That sounds like a flood to me.
I think the seaweed in your garage probably indicates flood.
Yeah.
And we made flood denials relatively straightforward to get. I mean, we want it, and we had to, right? Because we want people to start the process with the NFIP
Where
they are going to get covered.
So do you give them the phone number, or do you say, this is not covered, ma'am?
Yeah, exactly. You try to help them through the process as much as you can. Yeah.
How'd she take it? She was like, okay, I didn't realize that. Or she was like yelling at you.
She was pretty cool about it. Most people are.
Yeah.
Some people don't. They're emotionally upset. And in that circumstance, they don't always make rational decisions, right? And they need somebody they want to fix their problem, right? And so that's
why it was going to be you.
Right.
And that expectation has been violated.
Right, because it was never part of the expectation.
Yeah.
But that was their expectation. It doesn't mean it was, you're talking about human beings, right?
Sure.
So that was, that was a pretty rough time. But you also hear stories like, I love one of my favorite ones was this guy who called up and he goes, the guy in Jersey, I think, and he goes, there's a boat in my living room. And he goes, it's not my boat. And so, and he goes, but don't, and this is back when good chunks of the Jersey Shore didn't have power. I mean, all the civil services had fallen, gone down because all the, they were all flooded. And he goes, you just want to put the claim in, but don't worry about me. I know there are people worse off, because this boat, there's a full generator and the cooler's full of beer. And so I'll just hang out in the boat. I thought, man, human beings are going to survive. Yeah. And, eventually we got to, you have to triage, right? Because you can't deal with everything at once.
So the water picked up that boat and just smashed it into his house. Is that
what happened? Yeah. It happens a lot. That, if you were, depending on where you were in the Jersey Shore, that happened a lot.
Yeah.
Especially low. I mean, there was an enormous, enormous amount of storm surge, 20 plus feet. I mean, Manhattan got
20 feet.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, the water was coming in through Manhattan.
Yeah.
So, you have to, there's a lot of water. Mm-hmm. And that's very devastating.
Right. And as it kind of recedes, that is the claims activity, what are you left with? Lessons, thinking about it? And then how long did it take for it to kind of die down?
We paid our last claim this year.
Oh, wow. Okay. Right. 6 years later.
Yeah. We broke out the champagne for that one, but it's 90%+ of them are done within 90 days,
right?
And within 6 months, maybe 75% of them are done within 90 days. Mm-hmm. And the stragglers are always something. There's a problem, and disagreement over water, wind determination, or other issues, and some ambiguity of coverage. But I think that's pretty common. Mm-hmm. Our numbers, the numbers didn't move after about 6 months. Realistically, they came down over that time frame very slightly. Yeah. And we didn't end up with a lot less litigated claims than we anticipated. Not that largely because we're trying to extrapolate from Sandy experience. Excuse me, from Katrina. But the Northeast doesn't seem to have the same kind of litigation culture, or maybe. There just wasn't as much to talk about because, the company performed better. I don't know.
Yeah.
Different issues.
How about the regulatory environment? Because there was a publicity kind of issue for you, right? Mm-hmm. Where the regulator came out, I forget, I think it was in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you can talk a little bit about that. How did that come about? How'd you find that? That'd be a new one for you.
That was a totally new environment for me.
Yeah.
I've always had really good relationships with regulators and agencies because I've tried to, I've been fortunate in circumstances. Most of the people I've dealt with actually I thought were pretty rational, and realize that we're trying to do their job. We're trying to do our job, and they're trying to do their job. There are certain parts of no surprise to folks, but sometimes parts of regulatory groups will take a very strong consumer advocacy approach, which may or may not be done for their own reasons, which they feel are justified. We certainly find a very aggressive version of that in New York, and. Very frustrating for us, where the we had some late claims, and a lot of complaints. I think we had like 300 complaints out of 10,000 claims. Over half of those were because they were mad because we didn't cover flood,
right?
And so, we sort of pointed that little factoid out, but it didn't seem to matter in the conversations, but. Sometimes I think the political environment is that people need to make hay out of it.
Yep.
And that was at least my judgment what happened. But, it is what it is.
Yeah. So let's talk about the flood part of this. So flood's not included in a homeowner's insurance policy. The NFIP covers flood. It's kind of a hot topic these days in the insurance world where people are trying to solve that problem. The NFIP is perhaps changing.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to see. How much do you think the consumer appreciates what's going on?
I don't think very much at all.
Yeah.
I think, most people don't spend a lot of time thinking about their homeowner's insurance.
Yep.
For good reasons. There's a lot of other things to do in life.
Yep.
And I do think the way that we handle flood is just kind of messy. Mm. And certainly for, anytime you kind of get the politics involved and the whole elements around that, it just becomes a non-economic issue, right? It's just a question of, I want to live where I want to live and, you got to make sure I'm able to live there, and never mind the risk factors involved. So, the NFIP serves a purpose, but certainly doesn't do anything. We actually thought long and hard about whether we wanted to sell the NFIP policies or not. And I said, I'm not convinced that's something I really want to get associated with.
Why not?
Well, I think it disappoints people more than it actually makes them feel good, right?
Because how so? What's disappointing about it?
Well, the limited coverage.
Right.
You don't cover contents. You know, sub-basements. At least, I think the expectations that most people have around it is that there was a flood. Why isn't this covered?
Yeah.
And I think I hear more stories about disappointment than I hear about happiness after that, right? And, you know, it's not like we're going to make everybody happy, but I didn't want to create more circumstances where, you know, it's a product which is substandard relative to what I think I would want to sell,
mm-hmm.
Which is ideally something that it solves somebody's problem,
mm-hmm.
and more directly a standard homeowner's coverage. But you know, it's not to say it's a horrible product. It's just something that, you know, I didn't think was going to – I think that we're trying to look for better ideas.
Yeah. Another thing I want to make sure we talk about is technology systems. And so you're at a homeowner's company writing, I think that when you left Narragansett, 200,000 policies, some mm-hmm. kind of neighborhood with 100 people,
mm-hmm.
something like that. So that's some operational leverage.
Mm-hmm.
That comes from technology. how did you find your how'd you had a real big tangle with systems before that? Glacier, was that kind of or is Narragansett really where?
Yeah, Narragansett's a whole another. Yeah. That was more varsity version of this question. You know,
yeah.
The systems issues it. You know, you're talking about thousands of customers at a reinsurer, whereas you know you're talking about hundreds of thousands, if not you know more, at an insurer. So systems and those kind of elements become much more critical. You know, you've probably heard you know, people in the military say when you go to war, you know, the amateurs talk tactics and the pros talk logistics.
Yeah.
I think the analogy would be, you know, and if you're talking about insurance, you know, amateurs talk about accessing business and pros talk about systems.
Right. I mean, underwriting distribution, you're like, tell me how what the pipes look like.
Exactly. Because and highly underappreciated,
yeah.
right? You know, but we need to get bullets and beans and oil to the right people at the right place in order to make sure that they can do their job. And the same thing about, you know, how many times have you been in a, you know, in a conversation and saying, well, what's the data say? Right. Mm-hmm. And you're about to blow your brains out because, you know, to get it is, you know, 100 man years of work, right, which doesn't make a lot of sense, especially in this environment. So, yeah, we had spent a lot of time working on systems. That's certainly going to be one of my big takeaways is how to do that issue better mm-hmm. over time, because I think we did a decent job at Narragansett, but so many resources and time are devoted to trying to get that issue correct. And when you get it right, it's a competitive advantage. And, you know, I think whether it's a policy administration system or your data warehousing, you know, a lot of it, that's probably an underappreciated requirement to get those things right.
Mm-hmm. And what, so how do you do it better? How do you do it worse and how do you do it better?
Well, if there are two things I would walk away from is, you know, everybody thinks they're, well, it always starts with business requirements. What's the business problem you're trying to solve? Don't fall in love with the technology as so much as you're trying to solve the business problem. Really be disciplined about that question first. And, you know, what's the purpose of building the system? Not to have some whiz-bang technology. In fact, I'd rather have one that's a generation or two behind if it was solve my business problem cleanly.
Mm.
Right? And so that defining those business requirements and being disciplined about that early, I think, is really critical. And the second point is try to find something that's kind of off the shelf.
Mm.
If you try to configure things too much, try to customize things too much, you're going to pay for it. Especially when you're talking the size of companies, you know, that I've been involved with.
Yep.
If you're AIG, you know, they have more people in their help desk than we had in our entire company, probably. So you can be more customized. But the reality is, you know, a lot of that stuff is you just got to rely on the tools that you can work with.
And so maybe it's possible to talk about a system failure. Mm-hmm. Is there an example that comes to mind where, you know, like, I made this mistake and then this was the outcome. And now I would make a different decision later on. You don't know how specific you want to get, but
yeah. Well, I think, you know, look, I think as an executive, you know, we made mistakes around not being firm enough on staying in that customization configuration zone.
Right.
Right.
What's the temptation to leave it? Why would you, why do you not? Because everybody probably realizes that in some level, right?
Yeah, I think what seems to be the interaction that I saw what was the interaction I saw that I would push back on if I saw it again is that, you know, we've always done a business flow this way. We've always done it this way, and I want the system to mirror our business flow.
Right.
Whereas in some circumstances, you know, well, the circumstances I saw, there were with a modification of business flow, which would have made no material difference. You don't have to redo everything, right? And, you know, part of that is a system implementation is as much of a cultural issue as is anything else. And I, when I walked in to the company, we were in the process of transitioning from one system to another, and it was not going well. And a lot of, I think I was probably more sensitive to making sure the business parts, the business users were happy, and then the technology people were making them happy, right? And so when we went to the second question around technology, I think that lingered through, whereas I probably should have pushed back a lot harder on the business folks in order to say, look, the technology can't do that and everything else, or it's going to be too expensive to create that way. But it's all about balancing, right? And I think that balancing act, there's a lot of lessons to learn. But again, you don't learn these things until you actually make the mistakes.
Yeah.
And, you know, fortunately, it didn't, you know, just it slowed us down.
Yeah.
It probably made
didn't
stop us. And it just consumed a lot of resources and made it strategically difficult to do some other things. But, you know, it's choices.
I remember this makes me, this reminds me of high school football. So I remember high school football team. My coach was, he was all right. Our team wasn't that good. But he said, one of the things that he said, which was a good thing, he said, you know, you try and design the playbook around the resource, the team you have, as opposed to take the team and force them onto some plays that they can't execute. Right? You have limited talent. And I think that what's interesting about this is, you know, just pausing for a second and saying, sometimes truths are universal and sometimes they're not. In this case, it's not. Because in this case, you have a system that you actually do want to try and redesign the team a little bit to suit the system, because the cost of changing the system, swapping a play out and a football playbook is cheap, right?
Right.
Changing a system is not.
Right.
And maybe if there's a weakness amongst insurance executives or any executives, it's that they don't understand the costs of system changes and system modifications, and so they underestimate them.
Yeah. Well, I think that's probably universally the case.
Yeah.
Right? It's very difficult to – I mean, I certainly have appreciation if you change a field name, right, and the downstream consequences of what that means all the way through you know, not only your data warehouse, but how that might impact your financials and your GL and all. I mean, just those simple things actually can have consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And you think, well, just we'll change the name of the field, right? Well, it's not that simple, right? I mean, it can be. You can try to get it to a routinized point, but it takes organizational maturity to have that. You have to have the right talent and time and experience and checklists and all the things that, you know, that kind of make it go that way. But a lot of that, what you're describing is, you know, a situation that I use, a metaphor I use a lot in Narragansett is that I'm trying to get this company to 4-minute miles.
Mm-hmm.
We're not there yet. And screaming at them is not going to get them there, right? You have to start meeting them where they are. And if they're running 12-minute miles, that's great. They're 12-minute miles. Let's get them to 11.
Yeah.
We'll get them to 10.
Yeah.
And then we'll get them to 9.
You got to get to 10 before you get to 4.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's a lot of room in there. You got to kind of incrementally grow.
Yeah.
And, you know, that doesn't happen fast.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of this stuff that you do in business, really my feeling is, you know, continue your football metaphor. You know, you might remember a guy named Woody Hayes, who was the Ohio State football coach, legendary, you know, alpha, grab you by the face mask and scream at you to motivate you.
Yeah.
You know, I love some of his quotes, you know. You know, never pass because three things can happen and two of them are bad. You know, very insightful man there.
Yeah.
But he used to say his offense was 3 yards in a cloud of dust.
Right.
And I used to say a lot of what we do is that. And in fact, one of my board members coined the phrase, you know, strategy, execution is a strategy. And that's a lot of what we did. It's just execute at Narragansett. And, you know, that's not trivial to do day in and day out because it's just discipline and focus. And that's not always sexy, right? It's not strategic, you know. But at the end of the day, I don't eat strategy. You know, you have to have a good business proposition, but you have to execute. That's what you can take home.
Another phrase I heard recently, which I love, is culture eats strategy for breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool, right?
It is another one. Yep.
So let's talk a little bit about.
And that's one of the things actually at Narragansett. We just had our closing dinner for the sale, and you know, I said this to the folks, and I think it's really true. Is that was a wonderful opportunity where I thought we caught lightning.
Yep.
As a team, And we performed.
What do you mean by that? So do go into that. That's exactly where I was going to go next.
I anticipated this. I've certainly had the wonderful opportunity, and hopefully others as well, where you perform better as a group than you do individually, right? And you were able to accomplish something as a group that you probably wasn't available to you individually. And, you know, that's a wonderful experience. In fact, probably one of the most satisfying things I've been involved with. I was fortunate as a kid to play soccer at a reasonably competitive level, and I was with a group of guys. We were together for 6 years. And, you know, we got to the national championships and, you know, very competitive at different levels. And that was one of those experiences, right? We were just somebody that came together. And, you know, there's certainly this last round with Narragansett we did as well. And, you know, why? I don't know. Combination of culture, you know, focus, discipline, positive results, feeding on positive results. I mean, you know, you get feedback and you want to do more of it and that kind of thing. So that's kind of what I mean by it.
Yeah. So the team cohesive, mm-hmm. Everybody respects each other, likes each other, gets on with it.
Enough to get the job done, right? Yep. Which is the...
Well, more than that, yeah. Probably. Right?
Yeah, more than that.
Do the job really well.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is harder to do. And so ultimately, so Narragansett was sold late last year, 5.5 years with the company or so, if that's about right, mm-hmm. for you. Satisfying?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Deeply satisfying. I mean, not only the financial result we were able to achieve for our investors, which of course, you know, that's
the whole point.
That's why you get the job.
Yeah.
But but also this element of just catching lightning, because, mm-hmm. you know, we were able to take an organization and a team, and, you know, we all did well together. And that was very satisfying. It's hard to create.
Yeah.
But certainly something I'll be looking for in my next opportunity.
Yeah. And so what is next? What are you doing now? So you're back in the 6 month recovery period. That's right.
Yeah, exactly. I describe it as porpoising. You know, I got to go underwater when I go into the jobs, and then I got to come out of the water and mess around for a little bit.
Yeah.
Right now I'm just porpoising. Yeah. So I'm just chilling and trying to figure out what the next one is. Probably we are relocating from Rhode Island back to Texas.
Because you moved your family to Rhode Island.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this point, your kids were through end of high school, I guess.
Yeah, they were in high school. So moving to high schoolers was probably the second most effective way to really anger them.
Yeah.
The first one would be to take their car away.
Yeah.
Which I did not attempt to do. But my daughter, who's generally a very even-keeled kid, and the only time she really stomped her foot was the fact that driving age in Rhode Island is a year higher than it is in Texas.
Oh.
And she was like not particularly happy about that, but she, you know, time was on her side.
Yeah.
So we're heading back to Texas, and a lot of family stuff going on there. So we're going to get back to that community and figure out what the next opportunity is.
So running out of time here, what I'd like to close on actually is this idea of family. Because one of the things that I've always really appreciated about you is, you know, on paper, you list the things you've done. It's all really cool stuff. You know, you've achieved things. And at the same time, I've always felt like you've had a real grounding and kind of a value system that resonated with me, and something I hadn't really seen before I met you. And we met kind of in 2004, I think, or 5.
Back when you're known as Disco Dave?
Back when I was Disco Dave. And back when you were just trying to figure out how to make money in reinsurance. Most of us have figured it out, I guess, although my dancing's not any better. I'm wondering if you could reflect a bit on kind of like how does a family life look and feel, and how do you evaluate the priorities of family against, you know, ambition and against work satisfaction and those kinds of things? And
I thought you were going to give me a softball.
Yeah. I think we've been warmed up now. Time to hit you with the big one.
Oi. Look,
that's hard, right? I mean, it's so hard. It's so hard.
Yeah. Say something flip. I mean, a lot of my buddies, we all said our 30s just sucked.
Right.
Right. You're starting to have family. You're starting to grow your career.
Yeah.
You feel like there's just not enough of you to spread around.
God, Todd, that's how I feel.
Yeah. It's really rough.
Mm.
And it does get better. Past through 40s now or early 50s, it's, dramatically, we're now empty nesters. So I've been very fortunate, of course. You know, you start 70% plus of your happiness is who you marry, and getting that one right. And I've been very fortunate that way. I met my wife in business school. I used to tell people jokingly I went there to find some, you know, really attractive CEO who's going to take care of me the rest of my life. I got one out of two. I'm still working, but I got the other one. So, You know, I think, I don't know, we talk a lot with the kids about, you know, trying to give them insights to what I do. apropos of a question you asked me earlier, when I got to Narragansett, the question was, did you fire anybody today? Mm. And I was like, well, that's not what I do every day. In fact, I don't like to do it at all. But in fact, the opposite. And so, you know, but they'd try to give them insights to what you do. And,
did they understand, do you think?
Some. Yeah, to some extent. I mean, one thing I've always tried to do when I'm in town is to always get home for dinner, right? And, you know, family dinners are kind of one of those things. Fortunately, my career was flexible enough. I wasn't on a client service type job where I could do that, right? Yeah. So when I was in Dallas, you know, and, you know, we made it home for dinner all the time.
It's easy to work late, isn't it? And there's lots to do.
Yeah. That doesn't mean I didn't actually do homework, right?
Sure. After dinner.
After dinner. Exactly. Like the kids. Like they went to go do their homework and I went and do mine. And fortunately, that's, you know, it's just about trying to carve the time up. And I spent a lot of time on personal organization so that I can, you know, manage that. And because the information flow we all have to keep up with is, you know, monumental. But that's kind of how it worked. And so a lot of those conversations at dinner time, you know, is how you kind of pass those that along. It's a little bit trite, but I think there's a lot of truth to that simplicity.
Yeah. And one last maybe thought is, and we have spoken about this earlier today, is being successful is just about doing a lot of little things, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, like, I guess. I mean, think about the great tennis players, you know, Roger Federer, Nadal, Djokovic. I mean, they hit backhands and forehands just like you or me or anybody else, but they can do it when somebody's doing it. They can do it 5 hours into a match when somebody's hitting the ball 130 miles an hour at them, right? Yeah. Whereas I'm good when the tennis pro lobs it up for me, right? Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, just you have the ability to do those basics, and you watch those guys and you think, well, that's clearly what they're doing. And so just keep it simple and focus. It seems to be good things to keep your eyes on.
My guest today is Todd Hart. Todd, thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
It's a wrap.